leave both industries to the free market and view mass bankruptcies not as market failure, but market correction. Full separation of school and state may seem doctrinaire, but it has a pragmatic advantage over more moderate proposals. To quote humorist P.J. O'Rourke, giving money and power to government is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys. Publicly funded education has an awful track record, wasting hundreds of billions every year. Full separation transparently keeps government's untrustworthy hands away from the industry's control panel. A 95% separation policy, in contrast, is tricky to monitor, leaving education open to renewed abuse. By analogy, suppose a teenage boy has a track record of driving drunk. You could take away 95% of his driving privileges. To get behind the wheel, he has to pass a breathalyzer test, drive during daylight hours, and refuse teenage passengers. Yet, in light of the ongoing risk he'll squirm out of whatever rules you impose, confiscating the wayward motorist's car keys is the wiser course. Advocates of separation of school and state often compare their position to separation of church and state. The comparison is strange, yet reasonable. State-supported religion has a terrible track record. You could respond by limiting government to a small religious role. But small is fuzzy, hence open to abuse. The wiser course is to cut the cord between government and religion once and for all. Opposing any government religious policy may sound dogmatic in theory, but works well in practice. Once you concede government has been wasting hundreds of billions of dollars year in, year out, separation of school and state is a measured response. The case against government funding of primary education is definitely weaker than the case against high school and beyond. Since almost everyone in the United States at least starts high school, there is no clean way to calculate the selfish return for earlier grades. Nationally representative data on K through 8 curricula are also wanting, so there's no clear way to ballpark its signaling share or estimate its social return. If I had to leave tax-funded education one final toehold, I'd pick a modest, means-tested voucher program for primary education. Still, I'd be mildly opposed even if the exception were hermetically contained. Private charity apparently did a good job of educating the poor in 19th-century Britain and the United States. When Britain first made education compulsory for 5- to 10-year-olds in 1880, over 95% of 15-year-olds were already literate. Mid-19th century American literacy was comparable, at least outside the South. Since modern society is vastly richer, private charity is abler than ever to rescue the needy from ignorance. Yes, vouchers are arguably a more effective remedy, but arguably a more effective remedy fails to surmount my strong moral presumption in favor of leaving taxpayers alone. Disagree? Almost everyone does, and that's okay. You can reject my scruples without rejecting my story. You certainly don't need to be a libertarian to buy the social science. Autobiographically, my doubts about the social value of education long predated my discovery of political philosophy. What undermined my faith? First-hand experience. Soon after starting kindergarten, I started to realize in a childish way that I'd never use most of the material my teachers taught. Yet I also knew a bright future was waiting for me as long as I went through the motions. Once I was old enough to grasp that employers are greedy but not stupid, my rendezvous with the signaling model was almost unavoidable. Why not tax education? I have not changed my view that higher education has some positive externality, but I have become much more aware that it also has negative externalities. I am much more dubious than I was when I wrote Capitalism and Freedom that there is any justification at all for government subsidy of higher education. The spread of PC, political correctness, right now would seem to be a very strong negative externality, and certainly the 1960s student demonstrations were negative externalities from higher education. A full analysis along those lines might lead you to conclude that higher education should be taxed to offset its negative externalities. Milton Friedman, Letter to Richard Vedder. If discouraging education is such a good idea, why stop when subsidies hit zero? Why not go further by taxing it? The idea may be politically impossible, but so are all the best reforms we've explored. Unpopularity aside, is there anything wrong with taxing education? The straightforward objection is that education is not 100% signaling. My best guess, to repeat, is that education is about 80% signaling and 20% skill creation. Taxing all education risks throwing out the skill creation baby with the signaling bathwater. Yet on reflection, this is a weak response. True, an education tax might throw out the skill creation baby with the signaling bathwater, but cutting subsidies has exactly the same drawback. Imposing a 1% tax should discourage skill creation every bit as much as removing a 1% subsidy. A strong anti-tax argument begins by noting government has long and heavily sponsored wasteful education. Given this track record, trusting it to do the opposite is naive. Thus, even if an ideal government would actively discourage education, giving real governments the power to do so is folly. Picture the complexity of the tax code and opportunities for abuse if the education tax varied by major or school ranking. The transparent alternative is to bar government from the business of education. The decisive argument against this novel tax, however, is that almost all moral presumptions stand against it. Taxing education doesn't just butt against conventional presumptions in favor of education and the status quo. It runs afoul of the libertarian presumption in favor of leaving people alone. Since the proposal is untried, its effects remain speculative, and we shouldn't try it unless we know it works wonders. The false savior of online education. We lived through the stock market bubble and the housing bubble. Investments paid off for years, then collapsed. Will education share the same fate? Plenty of parents and pundits suspect so. For a rising generation of technophiles, however, the debate is over. They're convinced our education bubble is ready to burst, starting with higher education. Why now? Because today's internet teaches more effectively than old-school schools for a fraction of the cost. Online competition has already crushed traditional record companies, newspapers, and retailers. Brick-and-mortar schools are next in line. If the technophiles are right, squabbling about education spending is pretty pointless. Taxpayers are wasting billions on obsolete business models. But why fight over a sinking ship? Government cannot stop the power of disruptive innovation. If you want to make a difference, forget about education policy. Found an online education startup and become the change you wish to see in the world. When I explain the centrality of signaling, audiences often think I'm endorsing the technophile's story. This utterly misunderstands me. Education is not a bubble, but stable waste. As long as traditional education receives hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars every year, the status quo will stand. Online education will slowly carve out a niche, but that is all. Technophiles would have a compelling case if education's sole function were teaching job skills. Online education has clear pedagogical advantage over traditional education. Coursera, Khan Academy, Marginal Revolution University, and their rivals hire the best teachers in the world. Students can learn at their own pace, pausing whenever they need to reflect, rewinding whenever they need review, fast-forwarding as soon as they master the material. Anyone who's lost can drop a level without looking like a loser. Anyone who's bored can jump a level without looking like a nerd. Online education is an awesome way to build human capital. Unfortunately, students aren't hungry for human capital. They're hungry for signals. Why? Because the labor market mainly pays for credentials acquired, not skills learned. After years of hype, sophisticated technophiles are finally coming to terms with this fact. Kevin Carey of the New America Foundation explains the intellectual evolution. 3 years ago, technology was going to transform higher education. What happened? The failure of MOOCs, massive open online courses, to disrupt higher education has nothing to do with the quality of the courses themselves, many of which are quite good and getting better. Colleges are holding technology at bay because the only thing MOOCs provide is access to world-class professors at an unbeatable price. What they don't offer are official college degrees, the kind that can get you a job. And that, it turns out, is mostly what college students are paying for. Fans of online education are blessed with can-do spirit, so Carrie's epiphany leaves them unfazed. Education is mostly about signaling, fine. Then online education will soon let students send the labor market more accurate and detailed signals than brick-and-mortar schools ever dreamed. Employers want to know how smart you are? How conscientious? Great. Online schools will devise world-class tests of intelligence and conscientiousness, credibly communicate scores to employers, then sit back and watch their alumni prosper and their enrollment skyrocket. There's just one glaring problem. Testing traits offline has been dirt cheap for decades. Major companies spread test writing expenses over millions of students. The marginal cost is a few hours of students' time plus a little paper and ink. This is a pittance compared to all the time and money students burn in school. Why do students keep throwing fuel on the fire? Because employers don't take standardized tests from uncredentialed applicants seriously. Testing will be cheaper online than offline, but how does making cheap tests even cheaper change the way employers think? Technophiles shouldn't predict an online testing revolution until they can explain why there wasn't an offline testing revolution. My explanation, you may recall, is that education signals more than brains and work ethic. It also signals conformity, submission to social expectations. This traps students in a catch-22. Trying to unconventionally signal conformity signals nonconformity. In our society, you're supposed to go to college if you value success. When otherwise promising teens refuse to attend, they demonstrate they don't know or don't care what they're supposed to do. Protesting, "Why can't I signal my conformity online instead?" is further proof a kid can't or won't conform. In principle, social expectations can evolve over time. Still, as long as the first wave of students who jump ship from traditional to online education is weird, evolution will be slow at best. The revolution will begin when promising students say, "I've decided to drop out of school and study online," and adults unsarcastically respond, "Good idea." Why believe me rather than the technophiles? They haven't merely been wrong a few years in a row. Broadly construed, they've been wrong for ages. Videotapes of the world's best teachers could have replaced mediocre meat space lecturers 40 years ago. They didn't. Employers could have substituted standardized tests for traditional diplomas a century ago. They didn't. This is not an all-purpose "if your new idea was good, we'd already use it" argument. Any new idea takes time to get rolling. The point is that slight variations on the technophiles' ideas have been tried for decades, and none gained momentum. Online education is rapidly growing in two distinct directions. It is growing inside brick-and-mortar schools, so students can take some courses from home or dorm. It is also growing on countless educational websites, yet neither form of growth poses much threat to the educational status quo. Offering traditional students online options is a convenience, but leaves the fixed costs of campus almost unchanged. Educational websites primarily compete with blogs, podcasts, and other forms of online edutainment. Without a conventional diploma, "I took a bunch of online classes" is almost as worthless in the labor market as "I read lots of blogs." Though techno-optimists will dismiss my critique as stodgy fatalism, we need not sigh, let's agree to disagree. Anyone who confidently predicts imminent radical change should be eager to profit from my tunnel vision. On my blog, I've repeatedly challenged believers in the education bubble to bet me. Standard terms, 10 years from now, the fraction of 18 to 24-year-olds enrolled in four-year colleges will fall no more than 10% at even odds. Only one person has accepted, and the offer is still on the table. The politics of social desirability bias. Americans relentlessly gripe about schools and colleges, but virtually no one wants to cut spending on education. If education is as wasteful as I claim, why is it universally popular? The wisdom of crowds is fallible, But are we really supposed to believe billions of people from every major culture have converged on a common error? That's quite a bullet to bite. When you chew this bullet, however, it melts in your mouth. Collective folly is inherently plausible. Weigh the intellectual payoffs. When spending our personal resources, we retain a clear incentive to second-guess popular ideas. Consumers who discover a best-selling product is junk can unilaterally save their own money. Don't like it? Don't buy it. When spending collective resources, in contrast, second-guessing popular ideas is selfishly futile. Taxpayers who discover a beloved program is junk must pay their taxes like everyone else. Don't like it? You're only one person. Without the prominence and charisma to reverse public opinion, naysaying won't save you money but will make you enemies. The moral? In politics, critical thinking is an act of charity. Objective truth has to beg for spare change to survive. Owing to these perverse incentives, almost any political idea that becomes popular tends to remain popular, even if it's false, even if it's always been false. Why would the false become popular in the first place? Because human beings don't like expressing or believing ugly truths. Instead, we gravitate in word and thought to views that sound good. Psychologists call this social desirability bias. There's no such thing as a stupid child sounds better than 10% of children are stupid. We will win the war on terror sounds better than there's a 50% chance the war on terror reduces terrorism, a 30% chance it makes no difference, and a 20% chance it makes terrorism worse. Isn't what sounds good occasionally true? Certainly. When skinny people ask, "Am I fat?" the unbiased response is, "No." Social desirability bias distorts responses to "Am I fat?" because we want to say no to everyone. Social desirability bias takes many forms. The bald lie declaring "I love you" when you feel no love is only one. More typically, the bias works through intellectual laziness. It's not a lie if you believe it. And if you avoid calm deliberation, you can believe almost anything. What does this have to do with education? Education and social desirability bias are a perfect fit. Give a man a fish and he'll eat for a day, teach him to fish and he'll eat for a lifetime sounds lovely. So does, in a modern society, every child needs the best possible education. Education is the most important investment we make in our children's future, leaves a warm glow. We have to ensure everyone who might benefit from college attends is music to our ears. Such statements aren't blatant falsehoods, but we're inclined to hastily accept them regardless of their truth because they're emotionally appealing. With intellectual security this lacks, we should expect pro-education slogans to permeate our culture, whatever their merits. The only way to sort out the mess is to put crowd-pleasing aside and crunch the numbers. How can social desirability bias explain the ubiquity of pro-education sentiment? There are three top stories. One appeals to human universals. Underneath our diverse cultural baggage, we're much alike. Homo sapiens around the world, cotton to motherhood, sugar, clear skin, and caring, future-oriented idealistic slogans like, in a modern society, every child needs the best possible education. Populism is pretty similar all over the world because what's popular is pretty similar all over the world. A complimentary account, calling any popular view a fallacy is socially undesirable, and the human mind is naturally prone to the fallacy of composition. Since education has pretty good selfish returns, humans hastily infer matching social returns. What's true for the part must be true for the whole, right? Social desirability bias deters us from using our first-hand knowledge of the irrelevance of the curriculum to challenge this fallacy, even in the privacy of our own minds. The final story appeals to global elite culture. Non-Western elites straddle two worlds, Western elite culture and their own traditional cultures. After Western elites fell in love with education in the 19th century, they won over Western masses and non-Western elites. Non-Western elites, in turn, gradually spread the gospel of education to their own cultures. The global ubiquity of pro-education sentiment is no more puzzling than the global ubiquity of Abrahamic religions. What's so bad about social desirability bias? It is the fountainhead of wasteful and counterproductive policies. You know the mechanism. Almost all governments on Earth crave popularity. In democracies, leaders who fail to remain popular fail to remain leaders. In dictatorships, leaders who fail to remain popular can cling to power, but cling they must. Either way, leaders have a strong incentive to do whatever's popular, to be crowd pleasers. Responding, "That's all for the best," is wishful thinking. Look at the world, then think about human emotions. Many good policies sound bad. Many bad policies sound good. Politicians' natural response is not to counter social desirability bias, but pander to it, to demagogue. In a modern society, every child needs the best possible education? Great. Let's spend $1 trillion a year for the children. What about all the other goods we could have enjoyed instead? Oh, there's no trade-off. The more we spend on education, the richer we'll be. A maverick politician could call shenanigans on this wishful thinking, but joining the demagogues is far easier than beating them. Chapter 8. One is greater than zero. We need more vocational education. As anyone who has ever taught high school will attest, even among teens who attend the very best high schools, many simply hate school. They have never done well in school, see no relevance in it, never do assignments, and habitually cut classes or are truant. Why do policymakers seem to want to deny the existence of students who exhibit these attitudes and behaviors? Kenneth Gray, is high school career and technical education obsolete? Human capital enthusiasts normally defend education as it is. Existing schools greatly enhance students' job skills. They accordingly perceive the signaling model as an attack on a system that enriches us all. In principle, however, a human capital enthusiast could accept the ubiquity of signaling, then cry out for reform. Instead of treating the human capital model as an accurate description of education, they could treat it as a noble prescription for education. Let's transform our schools from time sinks to skill factories. How can we make this happen? Finding better ways to teach students reading, writing, and math is the conventional path. Since an army of researchers and practitioners are already working on this problem, I have little constructive to add. Yet overall, we should be pessimistic about improving basic skills. Why? Because the goal has long been popular, the research has long been ample, yet basic skills remain mediocre. The logical inference is either A, pinpointing ways to improve basic skills is elusive, or B, schools spurn the methods that work. Intellectually, for example, the case for firing bad teachers is solid, but who expects it to prevail? While there are signs of academic progress, they mostly look like teaching to the test. Until uncoached adults score better on reading, writing, and math tests, we should presume basic skills remain static. Rather than ride the basic skills bandwagon, this chapter highlights a neglected yet promising alternative, vocational education. Vocational education, also known as career and technical education, takes many guises, classroom training, apprenticeships, on-the-job training, and straight-up work experience, but they have much in common. All vocational education teaches specific job skills, and all vocational education revolves around learning by doing, not learning by listening. Prepare students for the future by teaching them how to do a job sounds unobjectionable. The most successful forms of vocational education, especially Germany's marvelous apprentice system, are the envy of almost everyone who scrutinizes them. Yet vocational education has long been on the defensive. Flowery arguments against vocational education drown out the prosaic arguments in its favor, and social desirability bias infects the whole debate. The standard case for vocational education starts with bitter facts. Plenty of kids find academics daunting and dull. College graduation, not to mention elite careers, is unrealistic for such students. Hence, they're better off training to be plumbers, electricians, or mechanics. The standard case against vocational education, in contrast, starts with sweet slogans. College prep readies students for whatever they choose to do with their lives. The world is full of late bloomers. Every child can grow up to be president. While the Friends of Vocational Education stand on firmer ground, both sides normally take human capital purism for granted. If two forms of education are equally lucrative, they equally benefit society. Signaling raises the debate to a new level and heavily tilts it toward vocationalism. The signaling model begs us to ask, why is this education lucrative? Does it teach students how to do a better job, or merely help students get a better job? Education that builds job skills is more socially valuable than education that merely impresses employers, even if both forms of education are equally profitable for the students themselves. Why vocational education rules. Career and technical education is to some students what advanced placement and honors courses are to others. Kenneth Gray, is high school career and technical education obsolete? Fans of college love to contrast the average college graduate to the average high school graduate. Fans of vocational education love to contrast successful plumbers, electricians, and mechanics to debt-ridden baristas with English degrees. Such comparisons don't just stack the deck. Worse, they lose sight of social returns. The search for desirable education policies should start by measuring effects on students' careers, yet no search is complete without a guesstimate of signaling's share. The selfish return to vocational education. In proponents' eyes, vocational education raises pay, reduces unemployment, and increases high school completion. Research, though a bit sparse, supports proponents on all counts. Core insight, vocational students are typically academic underachievers before entering the vocational track. The right metric isn't how do vocational students compare to average students, but rather how do vocational students compare to comparable students who didn't study a trade. Vocational ed fares well by this metric. It raises pay more than academic coursework. It reduces unemployment more than academic coursework. It even boosts high school graduation. The academically uninclined are less prone to quit school when they don't detest all their classes. Vocational education even seems to deter crime. Those who search for the most lucrative mix of academic and vocational education normally discover students are too academic for their own good. Most will earn more if they replace some, but not all, of their standard courses with vocational alternatives. Researchers do sporadically detect long-run drawbacks of vocational education. A notable paper finds that once workers reach their 50s, vocational backgrounds mildly retard employment rates. Given all the advantages of vocational ed for workers under 50, though, this is praising with faint damnation. Higher wages, higher employment, higher completion rates, snap all three pieces together, and the selfish return to vocational education in high school is at least a percentage point higher than normal. Weak and disgruntled students enjoy especially rich rewards. The social returns to vocational education. Signaling isn't the only reason selfish and social returns diverge. Public funding, taxation, redistribution, crime, and more play a role. Yet signaling's share is the axis around which all else revolves. What fraction of vocational ed's selfish benefits stem from signaling? The lowest estimates, strangely, come from vocational education's critics. Many inadvertently set its signaling share below zero. How so? Critics fear that vocational education bears a stigma. Specializing in auto shop tarnishes your image because society infers you lack the talent for anything better. Restated in the language of signaling, the vocational path sends bad signals about raw ability. In this scenario, vocational education enriches society more than it enriches vocational students. Society gains the extra productivity, but students capture the extra productivity, less the stigma. Imagine you're an average student contemplating the vocational track. With academic training, you produce $100 a day. Vocational training boosts your productivity to $120 a day. Unfortunately, the average vocational student's raw ability is $10 below average. If you go vocational, employers assume you fit this profile. Skills and stigma are a package deal, so you earn $110 a day, the productivity of the average vocational student, even though you personally produce $120 a day. Does vocational study really so tarnish your image? While it's tempting to declare the jury is still out, the truth is more like the jury has yet to be convened. To my knowledge, this lamented stigma remains unmeasured. Still, the critics probably go too far. In our society, even incurable snobs rank vocational students above high school dropouts. The signal vocational ed sends is weak, not bad. In any case, matching course content to job openings remains the most direct way to ballpark vocational ed's signaling share. All classes prepare students for some job. Auto shop teaches students how to repair cars. History teaches students how to do history. From a signaling standpoint, the issue is always, how often do students use the skills they learn? Vocational ed stands out because it prepares students for common jobs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the United States has roughly 900,000 carpenters, 700,000 auto mechanics, and 400,000 plumbers. Classic college prep classes like literature, foreign language, and history fall short because they prepare students for rare jobs. The whole U.S. employs only 129,000 writers, 64,000 translators, and 3,800 historians. What then is vocational education's signaling share? Bearing both stigma and job relevance in mind, half of normal is a reasonable guess. Suppose my earlier 80% signaling figure is correct, so 40% of vocational education's payoff stems from signaling. Then ignoring the selfish advantages of learning a trade, extra income, higher employment, better high school completion rates, the social return for vocational ed surpasses regular high schools by at least 4 percentage points. The social return for poor students, especially male poor students, exceeds 7%. Fiddling with the signaling assumption naturally shifts the bottom line, but as long as conventional schooling signaling share exceeds 50%, having it dramatically boosts social returns. What makes vocational ed's social return so ample? Status is zero sum, skill is not. Conventional education mostly helps students by raising their status, but average status cannot rise. Vocational education mostly helps students by building their skills, and average skill can rise. Why are social returns especially ample for poor students? Because vocational ed trains these crime-prone students for productive work without igniting severe credential inflation. What's wrong with child labor? Child labor has not always been thought of as an evil. There have been times when it was treated as unpleasant to the child, but nevertheless desirable, somewhat akin to our contemporary view of education. Kaushik Basu, Child Labor. School is not vocational education's only venue. If learning job skills in the school is good, wouldn't learning job skills on the job be better? Unfortunately, we have an innocuous yet infamous label for kids learning job skills on the job. Child labor. Civilized adults recoil at the name. Children with joy in their hearts don't belong in gray workshops toiling all day long, cogs in the machine. They're kids, not robots. Well, unless the gray workshop is called a school and the cogs earn zero wages. No one cares if kids devote every free minute to basketball or violin, but gainful employment is for grown-ups. Hostility to child labor admittedly mellows as children approach adulthood, but we're still supposed to spurn the idea of 16-year-olds quitting school to work full-time. Child labor laws reflect these popular sentiments. Federal regulations do more than exclude minors from dangerous jobs. Outside of family businesses, farming, newspaper delivery, and performing arts, work for kids under 14 is all but prohibited. U.S. federal law caps 14 and 15-year-olds' work at 3 hours a day on school days and 18 hours a week on school weeks. Plenty of states have stricter regulations. Under California law, 16 and 17-year-olds may not work without school permission or more than 4 hours on a school day. When children languish in school, adults run to rationalize. Making kids sit at desks doing boring, busy work may seem cruel, but their pain trains them for the future. Why, then, is child labor so reviled? Toil may not be fun, but it, too, trains kids for their future. Child labor has a dark side. Then again, so does book learning. When my mom was a schoolgirl, the nuns in charge freely hit kids with sticks. Judging either activity by long-gone creepy abuses is folly. In modern times, is there any decent reason to discourage kids from getting jobs and learning job skills? The silliest objection is that businesses exploit our children, handing them a pittance for their toil. No one expects schools to pay their students. The training kids receive is payment enough. Why hold firms to a higher standard? College students ferociously compete for unpaid internships because training is a valuable compensation, and total compensation, not cash alone, is what counts. In any case, if the young were really grossly underpaid, employing them would be extraordinarily profitable. And thanks to competition, few business models stay extraordinarily profitable for long. Another complaint is that children are too immature to know a bad deal when they see it. As a father of four, I don't demur, but we normally rely on parents to protect kids from their own childishness. Under current U.S. law, moms and dads can already employ their sons and daughters on almost any terms they please. The natural rationale is that few want to mistreat their flesh and blood. Exceptions notwithstanding, parents are children's best guardians. Once we trust them to decide whether they're fairly compensating their kids, why not trust parents to decide whether someone else is fairly compensating their kids? A more thoughtful objection is that work is good, but school is better. Child labor distracts youths from their primary mission, academic success. The critical premise is that the academic path is so reliably superior that leaving students the option to prioritize work over school is dangerous. On cursory look, the facts fit. Working students average lower grades, worse behavior, and more trouble with the law. But a closer look tells another tale altogether. Working students' visible shortcomings predate their employment. When researchers compare working students to comparable non-working students, work has a clear upside and no clear downside. Early job experience has durable dividends, boosting post-graduation earnings by 5, 10, or even 20% for at least a decade. The link between work and academic success, in contrast, is weak. The same goes for crime and other bad behavior. According to one intriguing study, looser child labor laws cut education and crime. Locking work-oriented students in school makes them act out. The two-thirds of 16 to 19-year-olds who don't even try to work during the school year are missing a major opportunity. To be clear, none of this research urges teens to quit high school to get full-time jobs. Researchers who hail the long-run career benefits of youthful employment remain skeptical of intense work, 30 or 40 hours a week. For selfish returns, they're probably right. In our society, high school dropouts bear a savage stigma. For public policy, however, selfish returns are a distraction. Social returns alone matter. Since stigma hurts only selfish returns, wise policy analysts ignore it. Instead, they compare skills students learn in class to skills students learn on the job. Frankly, there's no comparison. Doing any job teaches you how to do a job. If this seems a low bar, recall that almost half of dropouts and a third of high school graduates these days aren't even looking for work. Acclimating them to any form of employment would be a step up. Since the minimum wage doesn't vary by age or experience, we shouldn't worry that youths will be exploited. We should worry that youths, especially poor students, won't be hired at all. Under current law, untrained workers must produce the cost of their training plus $7.25 an hour to be profitably employed. Quite a catch-22, especially for slow learners. You need training to become a productive worker, but firms won't train you unless you already are a productive worker. Aren't unpaid internships a massive loophole? Not taking the law literally. In the for-profit sector, the U.S. Department of Labor allows unpaid internships only if the employer that provides the training derives no immediate advantage from the activities of the intern. A bizarre rule. Why would a for-profit firm bother hiring workers from whom it derives zero immediate advantage? If you sought to convince a CEO to start an internship program, your pitch wouldn't be, "Let's hire a bunch of inexperienced workers to provide our firm with no immediate benefits whatsoever." Unpaid internships survive because authorities hypocritically fail to enforce the letter of the law. As long as interns are college students or recent college grads learning a college-like job, government turns a blind eye. If McDonald's hired unpaid trainees, prosecution would be swift. Unlike orthodox observers, I hasten to add, I say we need more hypocrisy. Instead of ending the unofficial exemption for college interns, we should grant it to everyone. What else should policymakers do? Deregulate and destigmatize child labor. Early jobs are good for kids and good for society. Parental oversight isn't a perfect way to root out abuses, but we rely on it in virtually every other sphere of life. Parents can make their kids devote their childhoods to sports and music, no matter how much they hate playing. Parents can sign their kids up for mountain climbing. Parents can take their kids to dangerous countries. Holding non-familial employment to stricter standards than mountain climbing is senseless. Once child labor is legal, some teens will take full-time jobs. As long as they have their parents' permission, let them. If this means dropping out of high school, we should set our phobias aside and allow that, too. Selfishly speaking, the average dropout is making a mistake. Plenty of students, though, are not average, starting with the silent minority who like work and loathe school. Working enthusiastically probably has a higher selfish return than studying apathetically, because the labor market rewards graduation, not attendance. In any case, education policy should never lose sight of signaling. Students who quit school to work curb credential inflation, opening doors for peers who stay in school because you can't get a good job without a diploma. When Bill Gates dropped out of Harvard, he didn't just strike it rich, he struck a blow against credential inflation. What about setting up a formal apprenticeship system? The best regimes are jewels, but they're notoriously difficult to emulate. Most countries can't be Germany. Internationally, apprenticeship programs consistently outshine adult job training programs, but that's faint praise indeed. Before using taxpayer dollars to jumpstart apprenticeships, government should get out of the way and take stock of all the opportunities the labor market provides. Misvocational education, or one is greater than zero. Perhaps no greater mistake in terms is made in our educational practice today than to say that the high school student who has had 4 years of Latin, 3 of Greek, 4 of English, 2 of ancient and medieval history, 2 of mathematics, and 1 year of mathematical physics has pursued a liberal culture course of study. As a matter of fact, his course has been narrowly technical in that it leads to but a few selected occupations. And he is in no sense liberally educated, for he knows little about the modern world in which he lives. Elwood Cubberley, does the present trend toward vocational education threaten liberal culture? Most education experts remain leery of vocational ed. Chief objection, it's short-sighted. The vocational track teaches students specific skills they need for their first job. The academic track teaches students general skills they need for every job. The wise approach is to set everyone on the academic track. Let kids max out their general skills before targeting any particular vocation. This objection is confused. While literacy and numeracy are genuinely general skills, most academic classes amount to vocational training for ultra-rare vocations. Think about classic college prep in literature, history, social science, and foreign language. Only a handful of occupations use the skills these classes teach. Science and higher mathematics are more relevant, but even college grads rarely apply them on the job. STEM is vocational training for quants and scientists, not general thinking for workers. Ultimately, then, the debate is between two kinds of vocational education. Traditionalists, who want to train everyone for long-shot prestigious careers like author, historian, political scientist, translator, physicist, and mathematician. So-called vocationalists want to train students for careers they're likely to enter. The traditional route is painless for educators. Teach your students whatever your teachers taught you. The vocational route is painful for educators. To follow it, we must keep tabs on student aptitudes and the job market. So be it. To prepare youths for plausible futures, educators must feel the pain. Defenders of traditional academics often appeal to the obscurity of the future. The labor market is mercurial mutation. What's the point of prepping students for the economy of 2015 when they'll be employed in the economy of 2025 or 2050? Fair enough, but this is no argument for old-school academics. Ignorance of the future is no excuse for preparing students for occupations they almost surely won't have. And if we know anything about the future of work, we know that demand for authors, historians, political scientists, translators, physicists, and mathematicians will stay low. The crowd-pleasing objection to vocationalism, though, is not epistemic, but egalitarian. Placing everyone on the academic track seems more equal than sorting children by aptitude and assigning them to suitable training. You could say equality is already an illusion. Despite the fiction of college prep for all, colleges count only honors and AP as the genuine article. Yet the ambitious egalitarian would retort, then let's have honors and AP coursework for all. This sounds lovely, but works poorly. Egalitarians picture college prep as a free lunch. Anyone who fails academically can switch to the vocational track, so everyone might as well start with academics. This ignores the disturbing possibility that after academic students crash, they'll be too embittered to learn a trade. When such students start on the academic route, they learn how to do zero jobs. When they start on the vocational route, in contrast, they probably learn how to do one job. The vast American underclass shows this disturbing possibility is more than theoretically possible. Keeping bored, resentful kids on the academic track backfires. Instead of downshifting to vocational training, they settle for unskilled labor, or worse. Remember, about 20% of Americans never earn a standard high school diploma. Training likely dropouts to do a mid-skill job when they're 12 or 14 is no panacea, but it's more realistic than hoping they're late-blooming stars. Does this deprive such students of the chance to rise high up in the social ladder? Debatably. Yet it slashes their risk of starting adulthood bereft of marketable skills. High school dropouts aren't the only kids who learn how to do zero jobs. After graduation, plenty of high school and even college students taste how unqualified they are. Think of the timeless question, what can you do with an English degree? For many, as we've seen, the answer is be a bartender, cashier, cook, janitor, security guard, or waiter. Literally speaking, of course, no one uses their English degree to guard a warehouse. The real story is their education prepared them for no realistic occupation, so they learned how to guard warehouses on the job. Historically, teachers trained students for three specific professions, the clergy, law, and medicine. The modern curriculum is more versatile, but has changed far less than educators like to think. Today's schools prepare students for careers as authors, poets, mathematicians, scientists, artists, musicians, historians, translators, and professional athletes. Yet the fraction of students who enter these occupations is trivial. Contrary to popular pro-education rhetoric, schools devote little time to general skills. Instead, students spend their days training for jobs few want and even fewer get. As a result, many leave high school, college, and even grad school with zero realistic career options. Thankfully, most recover by absorbing useful skills on the job. Inexcusably, a sizable minority do not. All the years kids sit in school are more than enough to teach everyone how to do at least one job. And knowing one job is vastly better for the individual and mankind than knowing none. One is greater than zero. Youth Reimagined. Pig farmers, electricians, plumbers, bridge painters, jam makers, blacksmiths, brewers, coal miners, carpenters, crab fishermen, oil drillers. They all tell me the same thing over and over again and again. Our country has become emotionally disconnected from an essential part of our workforce. Even as unemployment remains sky high, a whole category of vital occupations has fallen out of favor, and companies struggle to find workers with the necessary skills. The causes seem clear. We have embraced a ridiculously narrow view of education. Any kind of training or study that does not come with a four-year degree is now deemed alternative. Many viable careers once aspired to are now seen as vocational consolation prizes. And many of the jobs this current administration has tried to create over the last 4 years are the same jobs that parents and teachers actively discourage kids from pursuing. I always thought there was something ill-fated about the promise of 3 million shovel-ready jobs made to a society that no longer encourages people to pick up a shovel. Mike Rowe, the first 4 years are the hardest. In backward nations, youths work. In advanced nations, youths study. As civilization advances, the young spend ever more years sequestered from paid employment. The modern fear is that work might interfere with school, never that school might interfere with work. These rules are so ingrained, they seem like laws of nature. The logic is elusive. As society evolves, teaching the young different occupations is common sense. Teaching them no occupations and hoping they adapt to the job market after graduation is not. It doesn't matter how futuristic our society becomes. Making kids study irrelevant material for a decade plus is timelessly dysfunctional. What's the alternative? Reboot vocational education. Sticking with the classic curriculum instead of trying to forecast the job market is looking for your keys under the streetlight because it's brighter there. Sure, teach the genuinely general skills, reading, writing, math. Otherwise, schools should make educated guesses about future career opportunities, measure students' aptitudes, then expose them to plausible occupations. Instead of viewing youth employment as exploitation or a risky distraction from school, we should celebrate work as vocational education in its purest form. When the young quit school to work full-time, we should not mourn. Such kids will never cure cancer, but at least they'll be self-supporting members of society. Isn't this a grim dystopian vision? Not at all. Visualize a world where 16-year-olds have real job skills and earn enough to provide for themselves. Visualize a world where academically uninclined preteens look up to apprentices instead of delinquents. Visualize a world where students find their lessons either practical or interesting. If we could raise a new, productive, independent, engaged generation, wouldn't that be a great improvement over the bored, infantilized youth of today? Instead of fearing a dystopian future, we should gawk at our dystopian present. In modern societies, achievement-oriented kids spend almost 2 decades in school. Most find the curriculum dreadfully dull. During this drawn-out ordeal, students are either poor or financially dependent on their parents. When they finally join the real world, graduates apply only a sliver of what they studied. Once they have kids of their own, they re-experience extended immaturity from the parents' side. Our status quo isn't 1984 or Brave New World. But if we weren't used to our education system, who would wish for it? Chapter 9. Nourishing Mother. Is education good for the soul? College graduates often proudly name-drop their alma mater, but few realize the phrase contains a worldview. In Latin, alma mater means nourishing mother, a rich metaphor. A nourishing mother doesn't merely teach you practical skills or help you land a well-paid job. She nurtures your whole person, teaches you right from wrong, and shows you the magic of life. As William Bowen, former president of Princeton, and Derek Bach, former president of Harvard, attest, education is a special, deeply political, almost sacred civic activity. It is not merely a technical enterprise, providing facts to the untutored. Inescapably, it is a moral and aesthetic enterprise, expressing to impressionable minds a set of convictions about how most nobly to live in the world. Most economists are dedicated fans of education, but still roll their eyes at such lofty words. They push education because they think it has a high social return, not because they think it good for the soul, whatever that means. Once in a while, philosophical economists muse education might be a merit good, a product with value above and beyond customers' willingness to pay, but such musings rarely sink in with their pragmatic peers. Economists' philistine ways expose them to a sharp humanist critique. An old-school fan of liberal arts education could chide, "You base your support for education on its high social return, but Kaplan convincingly shows this social return is poor at best. Those who live by the sword die by the sword." The humanist could then turn to me and add, "You don't win either. You may have beaten your fellow economists at their own game, but that game isn't worth playing." The humanist tradition remains the most meaningful perspective. Ideas and culture matter more than dollars and cents. I sincerely take the humanist critique to heart. For all my iconoclasm, I love ideas and culture. Impractical ideas and uncommercial culture are my life. The journey from ignorance to enlightenment moves me. Consider Malcolm X's spellbinding story about teaching himself to read in prison. "I saw that the best thing I could do was get hold of a dictionary, to study, to learn some words. I spent 2 days just rifling uncertainly through the dictionary's pages. I'd never realized so many words existed. I didn't know which words I needed to learn. Finally, just to start some kind of action, I began copying. I woke up the next morning thinking about those words, immensely proud to realize that not only had I written so much at one time, but I'd written words that I never knew were in the world. I was so fascinated that I went on. I copied the dictionary's next page, and the same experience came when I studied that. With every succeeding page, I also learned of people and places and events from history. Actually, the dictionary is like a miniature encyclopedia. Finally, the dictionary's A section had filled a whole tablet, and I went on into the B's. That was the way I started copying what eventually became the entire dictionary. I suppose it was inevitable that as my word base broadened, I could for the first time pick up a book and read, and now begin to understand what the book was saying. Anyone who has read a great deal can imagine the new world that opened. Unlike most economists, moreover, I think the value of ideas and culture reflects more than my personal tastes. Philosophy and opera really are merit goods. Reading David Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding is intrinsically better than reading E.L. James's 50 Shades of Grey. Hearing Richard Wagner's Tristan und Isolde is intrinsically better than hearing Toby Keith's White Trash with Money. Humanist fans of education grasp profundities typical economists carelessly dismiss. Old-school humanists nevertheless overstate their case. Education definitely can be good for the soul, but that hardly shows actually existing education achieves this noble end. In practice, education often turns out to be a neglectful or abusive mother rather than a nourishing one. Meritorious education. The master said, "In ancient times, men learned with a view to their own improvement. Nowadays, men learn with a view to the approbation of others." Confucius, The Analects. Practical education has no need to be uplifting. As long as students graduate with skills to apply outside the classroom, even academic drudgery serves a worthwhile purpose. When you have instrumental value, you don't need intrinsic value. To be a worthwhile end in itself, though, education must meet higher standards. To plausibly qualify as a merit good, It needs three ingredients. The first ingredient, worthy content. Learning about great ideas and glorious culture uplifts the soul. Learning about half-baked ideas and so-so culture, not so much. While the liberal arts tradition wisely prizes the value of grappling with error, this holds only for well-argued, thoughtful errors. The second ingredient, skillful pedagogy. Learning from enthusiastic teachers who have mastered their subjects uplifts the soul. Learning from uninspired teachers who parrot the textbook, not so much. Mediocre instruction is tolerable for practical training, but worthless for intellectual or artistic inspiration. The third ingredient, eager students. Sharing great ideas and glorious culture with students who find them fascinating uplifts their souls. Force-feeding great